You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
BP's Deepwater Horizon oil well blowout was bound to raise fundamental questions. How did the blowout happen, and why was the oil so difficult to contain? Did the government and BP do the right thing in response to the catastrophe? Should BP have been allowed to drill in the area in the first place? In fact, is drilling for oil in the deep ocean ever worth the risk? Months after the accident, answers to those questions continue to remain elusive. Even the things we thought we knew are still open to debate, like whether the blowout preventer really failed and whether the dispersants were the cause of the oil plumes. I'm pleased to welcome back to our show Tad Patzick, a professor and chair in the Department of Petroleum and Geosystems Engineering at the University of Texas at Austin. And also joining us is Dave Valentine, a professor in geochemistry at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Welcome to our show.
Good morning.
Tad, let's begin with you. Since our last discussion, you've been looking into what happened on the Deepwater Horizon in the last hours before the explosion. Take us through the sequence of human errors and poor decisions that led to the blowout.
Well, first of all, I don't think that we know everything, and I think that many details are still about to come out during the various hearings and proceedings. However, one must say that during the last day, starting more or less at 1 p.m., there was a sequence of events which, in my mind, have led directly to the accident. It all started from preparations for the negative pressure test, whose purpose it was to test if the well was not leaking. I need to perhaps step back and tell everybody that at that stage, every pipe in the well and in the riser that connected the well with the drilling rig was filled with drilling mud, which is very dense. It's about 65% denser than water and provided a lot of weight and pressure on the well. So at that stage, the workers on the rig started evacuating this drilling mud in bits and pieces. And so what they did was first they filled the additional lines, the choke and kill lines, and also a booster line, 3-inch lines that are leading to the blowout preventer and just beneath the blowout preventer with seawater. And that released pressure from these lines. Then they closed the valves in the blowout preventer in these three lines. Well, what they did then was something that they should not perhaps have done. They had 454 barrels of a very dense mud, which is called the lost circulation mud, that was treated as a toxic substance if it was not used. But if it came out of the wellbore, it was no longer a toxic substance, so they could dispose it by pumping it overboard. So what they did at that stage, at about 4 p.m., they pumped 454 barrels of that lost circulation mud into the wellbore to circulate it through the wellbore and to then get it on the other end and dispose it overboard. Now, what this mud did is that it's very dense, very viscous, and introduced one more fluid into the wellbore that confused their interpretation of the results. Well, then they followed that mud with seawater that was supposed to displace that mud. However, seawater is much lighter and less viscous than the mud, so it mixed with the mud, and it gave them unexpected pressure readings. Because of these unexpected pressure readings, they thought that one of the gauges was wrong and they believed more another pressure gauge. And it's a very long and complicated story, and it would take me probably an hour to lead you through it. But in the end, what happened prior to this negative pressure test, the workers did not know where was the mud, what were the pressure actually showing them, and they were generally confused.
Now, why would that be? These are people who have done this before and have done it successfully before. Was there something specifically different here? Was it a failure of the blowout preventer that caused the blowout, as was originally claimed?
No, this had nothing to do with a blowout preventer. It had to do with having one fluid above the well bore in the blowout preventer, in the riser, and in the choke and kill lines, especially the kill line. And instead, they had two or three fluids, and they were unable to clearly interpret the pressures. What happened then is that the well, at some point, the well started flowing. And it actually flowed 50-some barrels, which they disregarded. They thought that there was nothing wrong with that. The pressure on the drill pipe, which is the pipe through which they were delivering all the fluids into the wellbore, was increasing. They also thought that perhaps there was something wrong with the pressure gauge on that pipe. Instead, they relied on the pressure gauge in the kill line. What they probably did not understand clearly is that the kill line was filled with mud, not water, so it would give them lower pressure readings than they would expect. And so, in the end, they missed a clear sign of the well leaking, of the casing probably leaking at the wellhead and reservoir fluids getting into the wellbore. By the time they caught on with this realization, it was too late, and the blowout occurred. So I guess, to me, going through the sequence in the last from noon till, let's say, almost 10 p.m. on April the 20th, is sort of going like through a Greek tragedy. You know, by now we know what happened, and we know that this tragic sequence of events was unfolding. But the players on the scene, or the players in the tragedy, did not know that. And they were going through their procedures, and I think they missed many cues and many signals which were warning them during that evening.
Dave, could you tell us a bit about your academic research into cold seeps and methane gas in the deep ocean?
Sure. So my area of expertise is in methane, natural gas, and oil, and how they behave in nature. And one of the areas where we study oil and natural gas is in natural cold seep environments. These are areas where the underlying geological reservoirs that hold the oil and the gas are leaky, and there are conduits through the earth by which the oil and gas can migrate, and they come to the seafloor, and from there they can enter the water column overlying the seep areas. And so my particular areas are looking at the microorganisms that might be consuming the oil and the gas, and many of the processes that are active on the oil and the gas, both at the interface where it's emanating from the seafloor, but also in the overlying ocean waters.
Well, soon after the accident, you were asked to talk about how methane would behave in the deep ocean, and you predicted that the containment dome wouldn't work. How close were your predictions to what actually happened?
They were pretty much spot on. The concern I had when that containment dome was announced was that there would be a clogging with gas hydrate. It was already known at that time that this was a very gas-rich oil, that it was something like 30% of the weight of the oil is actually a gas. And because of that, that most of that gas is methane, when methane is under intense pressure and it gets cool, it forms something called a hydrate, which is a crystalline lattice structure of water with gas, methane molecules in particular, trapped inside of that crystal lattice structure. So when the oil and the gas emanate from the seafloor, the oil won't form a hydrate, but the gas will very rapidly form gas hydrate as it cools when it's under these intense pressures. That was my concern. I even contacted BP about this, and especially when I saw the design of that very first containment dome, it had rafters in the top. And to me, that was a major red flag, because those are nucleation sites where this gas hydrate would likely form. So, of course, when they put it on, that did happen, and I was not happy to be right about that.
Ted, what role did methane play in bringing the rig down? Are there procedures for managing the methane that comes up through the well?
Well, in general, presence of gas, of free gas, leads to abnormally high pressures. In when you're drilling a well, so what you then have to do is you have to counteract this by adjusting the weight of mud, the density of the drilling mud. But that was handled well. There were no major mishaps. They received several kicks, but that was nothing, to write home about. What I think they did not understand was, and they didn't, was that there was at the point of the blowout, there was gas and oil right underneath the seal on the casing at the wellhead, which was open to the riser tube all the way to the rig. We don't know. Either the casing was unseated by the pressure of the gas and the lowered pressure above it through the negative pressure test, or else the cement on the seal did not set properly and it was leaking. Either way, the seal leaked. And once it leaked, it goes very fast. Gas gets through it, and then gas would enter the riser, and it would take another 18 minutes or so for the gas at a very high pressure of 5,700 psi at the rig level to essentially explode the riser pipe, envelop the whole rig in a misty cloud of gas and water, and then the gas was ignited and the rig started burning.
Dave, in mid-June, while the oil was still gushing, you took a trip to the Gulf. What was the purpose of your trip and what did you discover?
Well, I was on a research expedition that was funded by the National Science Foundation. We were on board a vessel called the RV research vessel Cape Hatteras, which is run by the North Carolina Marine Consortium. And we had a group of 11 scientists from UC Santa Barbara and from Texas A&M University, and we were specifically looking at the natural gas that was emanating from the then ruptured wellbore. And the particular questions we were addressing, first, where the gas was. We knew there was a lot coming out, but there wasn't a good handle on where it was residing. So where it was and then what it was doing. These natural gases are food for bacteria. They have the potential to couple with oxygen and drop oxygen levels down fairly low. They have the potential to impact the ecosystem in a number of ways. And we were predicting that there would be more gas present in the deep water than there would be oil. And so they may be in some ways the dominant hydrocarbon that's in the deep water. So when we went, we had about 2 weeks to do our research, and we got within about 500 meters, about 1,500 feet of the actual leaking site. And we were able to do full water column profiling, meaning we could get samples from anywhere, any depth in the water, as close as about 3,000 feet from the site. And from that, we were able to track a number of different gas plumes that were forming. We found them exclusively in the deep water, meaning depths greater than about 2,500 feet. All of the gas that was emanating from this it seems to be dissolved in those deep waters and moves away with the currents. We found these large plume structures in a number of different directions, one of which was reported on in the journal Science last week, but we found plumes also in other directions. I should say that was by another group that reported the one plume. We found additional plumes in other directions. And we were able to track some of the biodegradation processes that were occurring within those plumes, meaning the bacterial consumption of some of the compounds. In addition, we were also doing a lot of sampling for oil and other components, the breakdown products of oil. But those are analyses that that take some time, and we're still waiting on those.
Well, after the explosion, all we talked about was the oil because we could see it. Should we have been talking more about the gas?
I think the oil is the primary toxic component that people worry most about. There's a number of reasons that it's useful to talk about the gas. It may be helpful for tracking some of the deep oil. It also is probably the primary driver of oxygen loss. And so as we track the different levels of oxygen loss in the deep water, the gas is going to be more important there than the oil will be. So there are some very good reasons that we should be tracking the gas, but not at the exclusion of the oil by any means.
We have to take a little break, and we'll come back to you, Tad, after we take a little break. My guests are Dave Valentine, professor of geochemistry at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and Tad Patzik, professor and chair in the Department of Petroleum and Geosystems Engineering at the University of Texas at Austin. We're talking about the BP oil spill, the knowns, and still many unknowns. We're talking about the BP oil spill, the knowns, and still many unknowns with Tad Patzik of the University of Texas at Austin and Dave Valentine at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And Tad, at the end of your last visit to this show, you said the oil industry and government did a terrible job responding to the spill. Could you talk about some of the crucial moments when you felt poor decisions were being made during the 86 days the oil was gushing?
Well, the first decision that was made was not to the government and the industry were not able to intercept the oil near the point where the oil was emerging, and there was no equipment ready or available to in fact try to capture oil before it surfaced by essentially having sort of big inverted umbrellas with, you know, big hoses sucking in on water and pumping water and oil, and then the oil would be separated from water.
Is that kind of equipment usually available?
No, it's not, but it's not that difficult to design it and to place it. And what I was very dismayed that attempts to do that were not made as soon as possible. In fact, in this particular instance, they were never made. And then, of course, once the oil spread, it is very difficult to capture it once it gets near the shore, because again, the techniques that were used, have not changed in the last 50 years, and so essentially you had sort of wet vacuum cleaners and booms and rubber pipes
and people donating their wigs.
Yes, and people donating their time, their boats, their whatever, and so this was kind of not something one would expect from an operation on that scale. And I must say, you know, that there are resources, or there were resources available in Holland, in Norway, and I think that these resources were not used to our full advantage.
Dave, to help us understand the plume of oil deep in the ocean, can you explain how the ocean is layered and where each of those layers comes from?
Yeah, so the it's a conceptually a lot of people don't recognize that the ocean is stratified with respect to density, but also with respect to temperature. So at the depths that this blowout occurred, which are about a mile, the temperature in the Gulf is about 4.7 degrees Celsius or something on the order of about 42 degrees Fahrenheit. Very, very cold water. The reason that that water is so cold is because the last time it saw the surface of the ocean was at a very, very cold place, being in the Arctic or in the Antarctic. So the ocean waters, as you go down, get colder and colder, and that's because they're from further and further toward the poles, and we call this a stratification of the ocean. So it also means that these waters, they're not going to be mixing up or down in any appreciable way because they're stuck at their different density levels, and they don't see the surface very often.
Do life forms go between the various layers?
Yeah, life forms can go between the various layers. Now, the bacteria don't tend to too much, but larger organisms certainly can migrate between the different layers, and there are quite a few organisms that will dive down for part of their life and up for part of it, or they may come up to feed and go down to hang out. And so those are some of the organisms we suspect are already being affected or were affected in the early stages of the spill. And I'll give you one example. When we were out there, we found quite a few organisms dead floating on the surface that are known as pyrosomes. Most people don't know about them. I, in fact, did not know about them. I thought they were sea cucumbers because that's what they look like, but it turns out that they don't live on the bottom like a sea cucumber. They float in the water, and they migrate up and down, and they're filter feeders. They're filtering water and collecting small particles for their food, and there were hundreds, if not thousands, of them dead floating on the surface. And this was all near where the oil is. Now, normally they live at about 1,500 feet down to about 3,000 or so feet, which is where these some of these deep plumes of oil were at that time. And so it's not a stretch that these things were filtering some toxic compounds either from the oil or breakdown products of the oil, and that was causing them to die and float to the surface.
Well, how much do we know about what goes on in the layers where the plume is?
Not a whole lot. You know, on a good day, we have trouble getting down to 3,000 feet and doing scientific experiments. We're largely limited to observation. There's only really a handful of scientific vessels, submarines, and remotely operated vehicles that operate in those depth ranges, and the ocean is a big place, you know, 70% of the Earth's surface. So we're talking about a tremendous area that has only been very poorly studied. So we really don't know much about the ecosystem. We don't know much about many of the creatures that live there, their lifestyles, their requirements, and we're it's a cold, dark place that is very foreign to us.
My guests are Dave Valentine, professor of geochemistry at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and Tad Patzik, a professor and chair in the Department of Petroleum and Geosystems Engineering at the University of Texas at Austin. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Ted, you've said that deepwater oil exploration is like going into outer space. It seems to me we probably know a little more about outer space than we know about what's going on in our own oceans, if what Dave just said is true.
Absolutely. In fact, I would argue that the deep ocean is a harsher environment than outer space, especially in terms of pressure. You know, you are exposed to pressures of the order of hundreds of atmospheres in the deep ocean, and then, of course, up to 1,000 and more than 1,000 atmospheres when you go deep for the oil, while the pressure difference between your space station and the outer space is only one atmosphere. So, yes, it's a very harsh, unforgiving environment, and therefore exploring it and drilling in it has to be done with utmost care and with utmost caution.
Well, Dave, you say there's very little academic research into oil spills and that most of the funding and resources are tied up in federal agencies. Is that because of the Oil Pollution Act of 1990?
Yeah, so the problem that we've been facing in this country for some time is that because of the Oil Pollution Act and the NRDA that comes with an oil spill, because of that those legal requirements, it's very difficult to study an oil spill as an academic scientist.
Because the oil spill is being treated like a crime scene?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The when there is an oil spill, it gets locked up into litigation. It effectively becomes a crime scene, and nobody wants academic scientists snooping around asking very basic level questions. We as academic scientists are not allowed into oil spill sites until after all of the litigation is complete and there's a sign-off process. This is an agreement that is basically between the federal government and the companies and the insurance companies that they have to mitigate this environment, and because of that, it's locked down to the outside world. And so, the very few oil spill scientists, they wear a lot of dark colored clothing and come in in skiffs at night to do their sampling because they're not really allowed to be there, and during the day they'll get run off by the Coast Guard. Not that I would ever do that. A number of spills have presented, horrible spills have presented opportunities to understand the processes that go on after an oil spill, but scientists are simply locked out. There was this massive spill that occurred right before the Asian tsunami. It occurred in this pristine little bay in Alaska where a number of us just happened to have been working for over a decade. We had the best baseline data set we ever could have had. We were not allowed into the site. We were not allowed near the site. There was no sampling allowed until the legal process had worked through and the environment had been, quote-unquote, remediated. So we in this country are severely lacking in our academic pursuit of oil in the environment. However, the federal government does have a cadre of scientists that study this, but in that case, they're not allowed to be releasing a lot of that information. A lot of it is toward the litigation. It doesn't appear in the peer review literature ever, and so as a result, I think our level of knowledge is not where it should be.
Well, Tad, you mentioned earlier Norway. What can we learn from countries like Norway and how they manage their offshore drilling?
Well, first of all, Norway is a very small country, which is, with a population roughly of 5 million people, a little bit more than the Bay Area, or maybe a little bit less these days. And it is also very heavily dependent on oil. That is, oil and Norway are one and the same. And in fact, all the wealth of Norway was generated by Statoil, Norwegian state oil company, that is actually controlled by the Norwegian government. So in Norway, it is much easier for the government and the oil companies to work together. There is not this sort of this antagonistic attitude that goes both ways and, in fact, makes research and understanding of what's happening a lot more difficult. So in that spirit, Norway introduced a much more goal-oriented supervision and control and regulation.
Did we just lose you? I think we just lost Tad. We'll get him back. Dave, wasn't there a test simulating deep water blowout in Norway that showed how oil would behave under those conditions?
Yeah, it's the only test that has ever been done, something that we would certainly never get approval for in this country, which is the release of a small amount of oil at great depth in the ocean. They called it the deep spill test. And I think it was something like 100 barrels of oil that were purposely released, not quite as deep as the Deepwater Horizon, but still in deep water. And so there were some important lessons that came from that. They were pretty well buried in reports, but that certainly came to light after this event. And one of the interesting phenomena that was reported from that was that there was oil in particular that got trapped in the deep waters. And the thinking is that as the oil buoyantly rises through the water, that's a fairly slow process, but there's a lot of turbulence. The oil is getting battered around, and tiny little micro droplets, almost like atomizing a perfume or something, tiny little droplets will pinch off from the main oil, the main globs of oil that are moving up, and if those particles or those droplets are small enough, then their buoyancy is insufficient to bring them through the water because the forces acting on the surface of the oil are greater than the buoyant forces. So they basically it's just too small to either rise or too small to fall. And so it ends up just staying with the water at the depth which it gets pinched off from the main plume. And as we're seeing in the Deepwater Horizon event, this is happening some 1,000 feet or 1,500 feet off the seafloor and at depths of something like 2,500 to 3,500 feet in this event.
Well, one of the ways of dealing with this has been the use of dispersants. Tad, there's a lot of concern that the dispersant corrects it will cause more harm to life in the deep ocean than the oil alone would have. What is in Corexit, and what's your understanding about its toxicity in the ocean compared to oil? And do you think the decision to use Corexit, and I'm throwing this out to both of you, was a good one?
Well, I really think that the jury is out on that. Corexit essentially is a surfactant, you know, like the one you would have in your kitchen and in your dishwasher. It has also some other substances that are mixed with that surfactant. Its essential role is to lower the interfacial tension between oil and water and help in breaking up oil into smaller droplets when they are subjected to high velocity flow, so, or to wind and waves and what have you. But the net effect of it is that these very tiny droplets that were dispersed by the subsurface injection of the surfactant of Corexit were then floating in the deep subsurface layers of the ocean, just as it was described before, and they only can rise very, very exceedingly slowly, or they do not rise at all. So these very small droplets can then be essentially misdiagnosed by various creatures and eaten, and then they, of course, obviously poison different forms of life. And so, you know, I'm not a biologist, and however, you know, I am uneasy about the side effects of using the surfactant. On the other hand, if you look just from the engineering point of view, it worked very efficiently in preventing a lot of oil appearing on the surface of the ocean. So take your pick.
Well, we have very little time, but I just want to address another matter. Dave, some researchers doubt the government's estimates of the size of the oil spill. They say estimating what was skimmed or burnt can be quantified, but the amount of oil in the plume is harder to estimate. And there was a recent peer-reviewed article in Science about the size of the plume. How did they measure it, and what did they find?
Yeah, so they measured one plume structure and not in its entirety. What they did was to use an autonomous underwater vehicle, which is basically like a submarine with no people in it, that is pre-programmed to fly through the water. And as payload on this autonomous underwater vehicle, they had some very nice tools, including a mass spectrometer. So they were able to, in real time, have this vehicle fly through the plume and zigzag back and forth to determine the extent of it from side to side to side. And by doing that, they were able to show a continuous plume that went off some 30-odd kilometers in the southwest away from the site at a depth of something on the order of 3,300 feet. However, that's not the only plume. When we were there, we overlapped with that group a couple of days on our cruise, and we also saw significant plumes that were to the north and to the east. So we know that there are large plumes that are floating around. They're being formed and moved by the currents, and the currents are doing some amount of spinning around and some amount of moving things away from the site. So there's not just one plume. There are many plumes. Some of them appear to be rather large, 30 kilometers by a couple of kilometers wide by something like 600 feet high. There's also ones at other depths that group did not analyze at all. So another plume overlying that deeper plume.
Tad, we are going to give you the last word.
Yes.
The last time you joined us, by the way, there's a link to that segment from August 10th on our show page at WNYC.org. You said that we can't know whether the new regulations enacted by Congress in the wake of the BP spill will solve the problems because the models we're using to calculate risk are wrong. What's the process for calculating risk using models, and why are they unable to give us the information that we need?
Well, because we don't know enough about the future. That's the simple answer. So one, the fundamental way to prevent a dangerous accident is to have multiple barriers that separate us from that accident. And I think that most major oil companies, you know, such as Chevron, Exxon, and Shell, have a very active policy in which whatever you do in the subsurface, you have to do it in such a way that at least two major barriers separate you from an accident. And by the way, the blowout preventer is not treated as a major barrier, it's treated as a backup. So, you know, I don't want to go into the mathematics of power distributions and multifractals and all these things that we don't understand very well. All I'm trying to say is that a practical way of going about drilling is to do it in such a way that even if we screw up once very, very seriously, still nothing happens because we have a second solid barrier between us and the disaster. Unfortunately, BP did not do that, did not follow this route, and the and we know the results.
I thank the two of you so much for being with us today. Tad Patzik, professor and chair in the Department of Petroleum and Geosystems Engineering at the University of Texas at Austin. Also, David Valentine, a professor of geochemistry at University of California, Santa Barbara.
Well, thank you very much. Pleasure.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.